You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 40, The Daner Hypothesis. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Muckle Mannequin's life-sized Spock figure, a visual take on TNG Season 8 by Bad Machinery's John Allison, the new animated parody Stalled Trek, A Mutt Time, the Vanguard finale, and the musical collection TNG The Ron Jones Project. Then in the feature, we're joined by John Tenuto and Sean Taranjo as we discuss the TOS episode, Operation Annihilate, the IDW Comics reimagining, and what we may see in the next movie. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
I'm fantastic, Chris, although not as fantastic as I will be in 5 days. In 5 days. Do you know what's happening in 5 days?
I have an idea.
I'm receiving my pad from the future, my new iPad, which it looks identical. I don't want to get off on a whole Apple tangent, but it looks pretty much exactly like what they'll be using in the 24th century. And I can have it. I can have it today.
So you got the model from the 24th century, not the one from the 29th century that was aboard Captain Braxton's time ship.
I should have, because that's the one that brings with it the holographic doctor that can follow me around everywhere. I did not get the 29th century, which I'm sure in 6 months I will be feeling the regret.
Probably so. When the real new iPad comes out, the newer iPad.
The super new iPad.
Which, according to a lot of pundits, they were going to announce, but apparently they couldn't, and it's just a huge failure what they put out right now.
Did you see Tim Cook's shirt was not tucked in?
Oh my
Apple,
God, I know.
Apple is doomed, Chris. It wasn't tucked in. There was a tie-dye Apple logo or something. The iPad doesn't even have 5G.
I can't believe they didn't put 5G in. I mean... I know. Under Tim Cook's leadership, I mean, you think Steve Ballmer's bad at Microsoft? I mean, Tim Cook's just going to drive Apple into the ground, which has been shown already by the iPhone 4S. Terrible sales. And now the terrible reception received by the new iPad, where Apple Store, I mean, you could just breeze right in because one wanted that thing. You just, no problem. No load on their servers whatsoever.
No, obviously.
So, Greg, I think we may be forgetting here that this is not our Mac podcast that we do, our Apple podcast. It is actually our Star Trek podcast.
Star Trek?
But
what's Star Trek?
Some show that I hear is rather popular. I think usually Mike and Dan do that podcast for us.
That's true.
But they asked us to fill in today. So before, however, we get into Star Trek news, we did want to talk about one kind of Star Trek related thing here, which was Terra Nova.
Right, which Terra Nova has sort of been ready-roomed, as it has been termed 5 seconds ago by me. Sort of what happened with Eureka, we talked about it on the show, and then right after that, it got canceled. Terra Nova, we talked about a couple months back, and now it has also gone the way of the Dodo Bird. Now, I guess Terra Nova is important to Star Trek fans because it is, or was, the new home of Brandon Braga and Rene Echevarria. Did you ever get a chance to see it, Chris?
Well, I haven't seen it yet because, now this is interesting, as often has been happening over the past year or two with American TV shows here, they're just starting to promote and show Terra Nova here. I want to say it's on Fox. Was it a Fox show in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was, yeah. So it's on Fox here. It's just started here, and it reminds me of cases like Pushing Daisies was one. What was the other recent one show that was on that got canceled very quickly? There's just been a lot of them that have started up there, and by the time they start releasing it here and promoting it, we already know that it's been canceled in the U.S., and we're going to get, at best, 2 seasons, maybe one, or in the case of Terra Nova, what is it, 11 episodes?
Yeah, I think they might have shot 13 total, including the pilot, and I think 11 aired Mm-hmm. And it just never got the ratings that it needed. But it's an expensive show. It's one that they expect to be able to show it overseas and make some of their money back. But it's just a case of they ran out of time. And it's an unfortunate thing about network television. You have to get viewers right out of the gate, especially if you're an expensive show like Terra Nova was, where they built the entire Terra Nova set. They had dinosaur effects every week. They had big name actors that they were having to pay, you know, real money. Stephen Lang, he may not be a huge Hollywood star, but he doesn't come cheap. So if they don't get their viewers right out of the gate, it's hard for a show like that to survive.
Yeah. Well, there may be one other thing going on here, Greg. Besides needing to get viewers quickly in Hollywood, I think a lot of producers haven't yet realized that they must also avoid having you talk about their show on The Ready Room.
Right.
Because it has really proven to be the kiss of death up to now.
Well, I keep getting these reverse press releases. You know, never release Terra Nova's on TV. Don't mention this. You know, Terra Nova stars all these people that please don't mention it. It's not on. It's not a good show. Don't worry about it. And I'm assuming everyone else is getting these too, but it's getting a little weird that they're coming right to my inbox and I don't see, you know, it's just an email straight to me from Brandon Braga. It's a little odd.
It is odd. So some people are catching on. And as soon as everyone does, TV fans will be able to watch their favorite shows for at least 3 or 4 seasons,
right.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. So I guess I just wanted to come on and apologize personally to all the fans of Terra Nova. Although, you know, from everyone I talked to, there aren't that many fans of Terra Nova, but I thought it was a pretty good show. So I guess technically I need to be apologizing to Brandon and Renee, because now the show won't ever get a chance to grow its own beard, a dinosaur beard of some sort.
Oh, God. I can just see one of the lead dinosaurs having a beard in the second season.
Putting its leg up on everything.
And you said, this dinosaur has so much more character and authority
right.
than he had in the first season. All right. Well, let's jump in also, Greg, today. We have a few mailbag items for this week. And I think we need some mailbag music. I'm going to have to work on that. We had a letter from Renee Roberts, who wrote into us previously. And Renee just pointed out that in Carbon Creek, for those who didn't pick up on this, it's kind of an obscure fact, but the Vulcan who stays behind in Carbon Creek was named Mestral, or Mestral, however it was pronounced in the episode. I'm not great with my French. Mm-hmm. But this was actually named after Georges de Mestral, who was the inventor of Velcro, which T'Pol sails at the end of the episode. So it was
right.
a nice little... cute little nod there. And another one that Renee pointed out is the fact that the character of Tamir, T'Pol's second foremother, I mm-hmm. believe is what it's called, right?
Mm-hmm.
May be a nod to the Mir space station as well.
Oh, that is an interesting point. I didn't actually catch that, but that is an interesting place that might have come from. Yeah, I always thought of the Velcro thing as sort of the Enterprise transparent aluminum situation.
Yeah, yeah. But it was cute.
Yeah, it's cute. It's, you know, we talked about the episode and that wasn't the greatest part, but it is a cute, and especially that they had the little nod to the actual guy who created it in reality.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so Renee, thanks for writing into mm-hmm. us on that. And we have another letter from Rebecca Skipper, and this is about our Carbon Creek commentary. And I'll just read a little bit here. Rebecca says, I've always respected and enjoyed The Ready Room, but my respect for all hosts has increased a few notches due to your excellent commentary on Carbon Creek, an episode that made little sense to me when I watched it the first time. The philosophical nature of Star Trek attracts me to the franchise in the first place, and I agree with both depictions of humans portrayed in Star Trek. Our compassion and potential are what will spur us back into space. Our need and desire to explore ourselves and our world will drive us back into space when appropriate, but I think there are other pertinent issues to address first, like physical needs, eliminating starvation, and so forth. So, Greg, I think what Rebecca, reading her letter, I know that Michael talked a good bit about us getting back into space, but I think our point of the discussion also was largely that there are all of these issues on Earth that need to be mm-hmm. resolved at this point. in addition to getting out in space. So I'm glad we were able to connect with Rebecca, and hopefully with a lot of the other listeners there on some of the more philosophical points that were in Carbon Creek, as we talked about, despite the fact that many might see it as kind of derivative of City on the Edge of Forever and some other episodes.
Yeah, I hope we were able to be philosophical without being political. You know, I don't think we came out on either side of Republican or Democrat, or we don't. It's not that we don't care what happens in the upcoming election, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the bigger issues. And, you know, it's important to remember that, you know, in the 23rd century, they're not going to care whether Rick Santorum or Obama was president of the United States in 2012. That's not going to be the key differentiator. The key differentiator is the people themselves and what they do, and, you know, scientific advances and discoveries and those sort of things are what's going to drive things, not little political discussions. So
yeah, exactly.
Just want to mention that to people who might have gotten a political vibe from it. We're not trying to be a political show for sure, but these are really important issues for everyone right now.
Yeah, it's the big picture of society and where we're headed, and the only way to solve the problems is by coming together, regardless of what side you're on.
Exactly.
And that's where we were headed with our Carbon Creek discussion as well. So, Rebecca, thank you for writing in to us, and we're glad that you enjoyed the commentary, and we were able to connect with you there a bit. All right, so jumping into news, Greg. Now, this first story we have, I had to include largely just for the inherent comedic potential of the story, and this is a new product from Muckle Mannequins, and it is a life-sized Spock figure.
It's life-size. I mean, it's actually as tall as Leonard Nimoy, as wide as Leonard Nimoy. It's so real you could go up and hug it. At least that's what Uhura does every single time she sees it.
Well, I have a feeling that we have a lot of followers on Twitter who we talk to regularly who may be doing exactly that, ordering one of these Muckle Mannequins life-size Spocks and hugging it daily.
Yes, I don't know who is the audience for this. I mean, I guess if I had a Hard Rock Cafe, I might pick one of these up. So that makes sense. I want to know who is the diehard Star Trek fan who just has one of these in his living room.
Right. And not only that, but these things are going to set you back $3,000. So you have to really, really love Spock to go in for one of these.
That's very true. I don't want to talk about real dolls here on the show. That's for the After Dark show. But we're talking real doll money with this Spock, this life-size Spock. And there's not much you can do with Spock other than just hug him or look at him. I believe they do have even plans. They're going to make a Captain Kirk. They're going to, I'm assuming, Chekhov, Sulu. They're going to have the whole cast eventually.
I think so. They say that they are already working on a Captain Kirk. And now my question for you, Greg, is are you going to wait and are you going to get the life-size Empress Hoshi figure when it comes out?
I'm actually working on my life-size Empress Hoshi in my garage right now as we speak.
I see. You're making your own. Okay.
Yes, I understand. I can't wait. I mean, by the time they get to it, I mean, it's going to be too late at that point.
Yeah. All right.
Well, yeah, I imagine I'll just wait and hold off. And once they've got the entire crew, I'll buy it as a, you know, as a set. I'm sure it'll be, you know, a discount. It'll only be, you know, $20,000 or $40,000 or $80,000 at that point when you just buy them all together.
I could just see the box that they all come in lined up there like the... like the figure set. That would be awesome. You need a big truck to deliver that to your house.
Well, this is the thing. Like, so when you're a kid, you buy the action figures and you play with them. Is this the logical progression? Like, when you're a kid, you play with a little toy. When you're an adult, you play with... Are you expected to, like, pick it up and make little noises and have them, you know, go on adventures together?
I think so. But see, these are large enough that you can actually hide behind them and wiggle your way across the room.
Nice.
So you bring, I could just see parties, you know, like you invite your friends over, have some drinks, everyone chooses a figure, and you just reenact your favorite scenes from Star Trek right there in your living room.
Scotty, beam me up. That's perfect. I am imagining it now. I mean, this is for people who have the, Who's that guy who like transformed his entire house to look like the Voyager?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't remember his name, although he recently lost all that in a divorce.
Right, he had to restore the house so they could sell it as just a normal house, which is incredibly
And he couldn't
painful.
Just say, computer, end program.
That would be the key. Well, see, I mean, this is the primary difference between us and, you know, William Riker. William Riker wanted the same thing. He wanted all of his favorite characters with him in real life, but he could go on the holodeck and create them and go on adventures with them. We have to spend upwards of $5,000 to have them with us in our living room.
Exactly. Okay, well, if anyone's interested in checking this out, it is quite an impressive figure. Is German sculptor Mark Klinert has produced it and done an excellent job of capturing the likeness of Spock. And this is the Leonard Nimoy Spock, if I'm correct here, Greg. Mm-hmm. And you can find out more over at StarTrek.com. They have an article about this, and it's also available, I believe, for purchase in the Star Trek store on StarTrek.com, the official store. And the production is going to be limited to 300 figures, which, as a collector's item, sounds like a small number. But then again, if you think of it, what if 300 Spocks suddenly popped up? It's kind of like that episode, you know, with all the Worfs everywhere. Right. Was that Parallels, right?
Yes.
Kind of like that. I mean, I'd kind of freak out, actually, if 300 Spocks popped up in my room. So a low number for a collector's item, big number for Spock.
It's a great opportunity for one of those flash mobs they love doing. You know, get all 300 people who own life-size Spocks to show up in a Best Buy at the same time.
That would be awesome. Yeah. I could definitely go for that.
That's fantastic.
Okay. All right. So let's go on to the next story here, Greg. Now, this is just a little comic that came up. We've talked before about TNG Season 8, the account on Twitter, which they tweet plots from the unfilmed 8th season of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yes. And it is one of my favorite, it's one of my favorite Twitter accounts of all time. Every single time they tweet, I love it. And I saw this tweet when it came out, but it wasn't until you added this to the news that I actually saw the picture. So I'm gonna read the tweet, and then people can go and actually see the image. It says, "Picard must debate a sentient mountain to distract it while he and Riker climb to safety. Geordi's new girlfriend despises Data." And this is what I love, because they always have the subplot.
Also, yes.
It's because every TNG episode needs its primary plot and then its little odd goofball subplot. And every single season 8 episode still has that subplot. And it's been brought
to
life.
In the tweet.
In the tweet, yes. It's right there in the tweet. They always get in 140 characters. So this is an image that's been created by the artist of Bad Machinery, John Allison. Chris, have you ever read Bad Machinery?
Actually, no, I don't think I have.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's actually one of my favorite webcomics that I don't read regularly just because it's kind of dense and the background's intense. But it's very well drawn, very well written, and it's very funny. And it looks like this was done as a commission for the Season 8 tweet team. I'm assuming mm-hmm. it's a team of writers there at Season 8.
I think so. And I found it on io9, the website io9.com. Mm-hmm. They actually have the comic, and I imagine probably elsewhere as well. But we'll put a link to it in the show notes so everyone can go and check it out. But I love the illustration. I particularly love the look on Geordi's girlfriend's face. And I don't know what the hell Data's doing over there.
No, I really don't.
But this look on this girl's face, yes, she despises Data. You can tell.
you gotta wonder, like, what is, I want so many of these tweets, I want to write the episode. Because I want to know, what is it about Data that makes her despise him so much? And obviously in this image, he's doing something weird and creepy on the surface of this planet. But what is it? What did Data do?
You know, and the dynamic, it's kind of like on Deep Space Nine when you have Bashir and O'Brien, and they're such close friends that there can be a problem. I mean, there actually was a problem, I guess, with Esri, wasn't there? Where she felt like Right. There's like this division. You know, she's competing with O'Brien, you know, for Julian's attention, right? And, you know, Data and Geordi are close friends on The Next Generation. And so obviously this girl feels that she despises Data. He's kind of like the third wheel. Maybe he's like Wallowitz on The Big Bang Theory.
Right, right. I'm imagining Data, you know, following them on dates to 10 forward into the holodeck. And, you know, Geordi has no idea. You know, Geordi's like, Data's coming along. You know, I love him. You know, come on, Data, let's do a barrel roll together.
And she wants to do all the barrel rolls with Geordi herself.
Exactly.
So it's, I mean, a lot of tension going on in that relationship. And I would love to hear the debate that Picard's having with the sentient mountain as well.
Yes.
Which he has to do as he's climbing, right? He cannot do it and then climb.
Right, because I guess the mountain would throw them off, but as long as he's debating, they can continue to scale it. You know, I don't know if on a shoestring budget as TNG had, if they could afford the sentient mountain, but it's one of those grand ideas that I'm sure would have been in season 8.
For sure. All right, so we'll put a link to this in the show notes as well if you'd like to see the comic, and we also encourage everyone to follow TNG_S8 on Twitter. That's the username for the writers who share with you plots from TNG's unfilmed season 8.
Yes. And stay tuned for my shooting script version of many of them once I find a spare minute to actually put it together.
You got to get that Kickstarter site going, Greg.
There you go. All right. I'm sure Will Wheaton, you know, if I get enough money and actually get the sets built, Will Wheaton will surely come on. And once he's on, I'm sure I'll get the others.
Absolutely. Speaking of Kickstarter, Greg, we received some information from Mark Largent, who is trying to produce an animated parody of Star Trek and using Kickstarter as the springboard for this. Although, as you can see in a YouTube video that they have out, as well as some other images, they have a good start on what they're doing here. I kind of get the feeling that they've already produced it largely, but actually getting it out to the world is the next step.
Yeah,
and this is something called A Mutt Time.
Right. Yeah, it looks... I actually have yet to see the YouTube video, but I've just seen the images of it, and I've read what they wrote on Kickstarter. It looks pretty funny, I love this sort of parody.
I like the puppet style that they're doing here. Now, these are like felt puppets, I believe, aren't they?
Right. It reminds me of what was that show on Comedy Central, Crank Yankers, where they just sort of have the big mouth that just flops open.
Yeah.
And they're very expressive faces, which I love. I love cartoony versions. Chris Pine himself is sort of a cartoony version of Kirk, and this is taking it a little bit further and making it an actual felt puppet.
Yeah. And they're actually being done as 3D animation, I believe, but the look of it is to make it to look like felt puppets. And they apparently have a Spock on the bridge inside a giant cage called Portapet. So I don't know where that's going, but obviously there's something to this storyline.
Yes, I'm very excited to see this. And they're only asking for $600, and they've already raised $1,167 as of recording. So they are fully funded. So if you want to continue to get in on this, I'm sure you can be sent copies of it, copies of the DVD once it's released, if you pledge $25 or more. So get in on it. Is there an easy URL to give people so they can check it out?
Well, we have the Kickstarter URL. It's kind of long, so I think if you want to check it out, the best thing for you to do is to go to our website, go to the show page for this episode of The Ready Room. It's trek.fm/TRR40, the number 40, and look in the show notes, and we'll have a link there for the story, and then you can hop over to the Kickstarter site. You can also hop over to YouTube and see the video that they've put together. And they are the first one, anyway, that they're doing here. It's called A Mutt Time, and it's a parody of the classic episode A Mock Time.
Right.
And it's going to be about 15 minutes long. And Mark says they're going to do a shorter version that will be broken up into four episodes of a web series called The Punk Show that he plans to launch in early April. And Greg, you mentioned the DVD, and part of the plan is to launch this in April and then create the DVD, and that will be available at conventions in May.
Right.
If all goes according to schedule.
Right, which now that they've raised almost twice their goal, maybe we'll even see more. You know, I haven't had enough time to think of what some other great titles could be, but a Mutt Time is a pretty good start.
Yes, it is. So we'll have more information for that in the show notes, and you can go check it out. And good luck to Mark getting that off the ground and launched out to the world.
Yeah.
So, Greg, next story ties into one of your favorite people, Doug Drexler.
Yes, yes, indeed. I guess the Star Trek Vanguard story is coming to a close, as I believe we've talked about before. And there's basically just been some information put up at David Mack's website with basically plans of the Sagittarius, some technical info. I really need to, we keep talking about doing an episode where we talk about the books. And this is probably a great place to start, is with this really cool Vanguard series.
Right, yeah. And the way this ties into Doug Drexler is that he does the cover art for the Vanguard books,
exactly.
Which are just beautiful work showing the station and the ships. The ship in Vanguard is the USS Sagittarius. The station is called Vanguard. It's actually Starbase 47, but it goes by the name Vanguard.
Right.
And David Mack created this series back in, the first book came out in 2005 anyway, and he writes it together with Dayton Ward, who we had on Matterstream a couple of weeks ago, and whose new TOS book just came out, and also Kevin Dillmore and Marco Palmieri. And it's a very interesting series that takes place in the TOS time period, but it doesn't actually involve the TOS crew of the Enterprise. You have, it's like, see, we talk about this often, Greg, when we talk about Deep Space Nine, especially when Brian Finifter's on with us, about how Deep Space Nine shows that there's so much more going on in the Star Trek universe. And that's what the Vanguard series does for the TOS time period, showing that there are other ships, there are other officers and other events taking place in the universe at the same time that we see Kirk and his crew going around.
Yeah, and I think that's something that at least the producers of the TV shows didn't quite understand, that we wanted to see, and maybe there's just no budget for it, but we want to see the whole Federation, and we want to see all these things that are going on that aren't necessarily one important ship. You know, let us see, you know, just, you know, what is it like day to day at the Federation, you know, at Federation headquarters, you know, what about on, you know, not a space station out in the reaches of nowhere in the frontier, what's just a normal space station like? You know, I can't imagine it's just, you know, easy going every day. There's got to be interesting things going on with all these different species and interactions. And to set it in the original series era makes it even more interesting, because we did not get a chance at all in the original series to get into the sort of history. It's all brushed sort of at the edges. But things didn't get fleshed out until Next Generation. So going back and filling in some of those details that were missed is really great.
And even then, there is a lot of action taking place. You know, the Vanguard space station is built, and as the story gets set up, it's kind of unexpectedly established. No one's quite sure, why does the Federation put a starbase here? It's near an area called the Taurus Reach, you know, and it plays into the Tholian Assembly, and I think Kirk and the Enterprise actually go to Vanguard, to that starbase in the first book, and set everything into motion. But there are some big dangers to the galaxy that are addressed in the book, and the characters there play an important role in the Star Trek universe, just as the crews we're familiar with are. So if you want more stories from that time period and to see what the bigger picture is like, definitely recommend the Vanguard series.
I'm thinking maybe we should just like nail it down and say in 2 months, we'll have read all of the books and we'll have a show where we discuss it. So I don't know if we can have that pledge right here, right now, but I think it's definitely coming, and I'd love for our listeners to be familiar with the books when we do get around to discussing it.
Yeah, a little down the road, we'll definitely have to do a show on this. The final book is coming out this month, March. It's called Storming Heaven. It's written by David Mack. And so you can look for that in the bookstores, on Kindle, iBooks, whatever you use.
Will it be available on my new iPad?
I'm pretty sure it will. In full cornea resolution. All right. And if you go to davidmack.pro/vanguard.html, that's the special Vanguard finale page that David has set up. That address is the .pro is the domain, you know, like .com. Right. So it's davidmack.pro. And as Greg was saying, there are early plans as well as later plans of the station, interior, exterior of the Sagittarius as PDFs. David Mack's own Arthur annotations for Harbinger, Summon the Thunder, and Reap the Whirlwind are up there. And there's some beautiful full 2560 by 1600 resolution wallpaper with Doug Drexler's artwork from the covers. All kinds of cool stuff there. So go check that out, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Very cool. Very cool. And I guess we have one more story to talk about, which is another thing I had no idea about until I saw it in the show notes. We talked a lot about these music sets. Now, they've been from the movies. We talked about Star Trek, was it 4, and then Star Trek 6.
Yeah.
Are having these deluxe music sets. But this is something, I mean, this is a huge project. Why don't you explain to me a little bit what the Ron Jones project is for the Next Generation?
Yeah, now this is something, now it's not new, it has been out. We were talking to John Tenuto about it. So John Tenuto, who's joining us today for the feature, and who also was with me on MatterStream last week, he wrote a review of this for TrekMovie.com, and it's, the sets of music is not new, it has been out for a while, but I didn't know about it, and it is a 14-disc set of music from the Next Generation. And it's put out by Film Score Monthly. And it's amazing. You know, if you like, this is something I like to do. I've mentioned on the show a number of times that not only watching episodes, but I like to take episodes and export the audio and just listen to the episode so I can really focus on the dialogue. But the other thing that you focus on in that case is you hear the music so much more than you do when the visuals are competing with it.
Yeah.
And if you like the music, the background music for the various episodes of The Next Generation, this set has, I don't know that it's everything, because we had, what, 178 episodes of The Next Generation. Ron Jones worked on more than 40 episodes of The Next Generation. And so the Ron Jones collection here is a comprehensive collection of his work for that series and the musical scores that were written.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. I especially love the look of the box itself. It's very next gen. It has that Elkars look. This is an expensive set, right? It's $150. But as you say, for people who love next gen and love the music, it looks to be an absolute must have, really.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is $150. But you know, you're getting 14 discs here. And I think the price, I mean, it's like $10 a disc, basically.
Right.
It's like a normal album price. So for collectors, I think it's a very reasonable price. And at some point, I'm going to have to pick it up. I actually think that you can go on iTunes, at least on iTunes and Amazon, and get the individual discs, I believe, instead of buying the whole set at one time.
That might be a little easier.
It might be a little bit easier for you to collect it over time. Of course, you'd be getting it digital. You wouldn't be getting this very nice box, you know, physical box that you have here. But that would be one way to do it. You can also go to filmscoremonthly.com and you can order it directly from them. I didn't check this, but I suspect that on a place like Amazon, you could order the physical box set as well, you know, just as a product. It includes liner notes. And it has a 60-page booklet in the set. It's got pictures from the episodes and some video games that Jones wrote music for, He conducts and composes. It has a 6-page essay by Jeff Bond and Lucas Kendall. And it has all sorts of little tidbits, if you like trivia about the music. That's all in there as well. And it's just a very interesting set. As John points out in his review, it highlights how the music in The Next Generation changed after Gene Roddenberry's involvement in the series waned and Rick Berman really took over, and how the early season, and you notice this too, like if you watch Encounter at Farpoint, The Naked Now, these episodes, you really feel how that music had more in common with the original series from the 60s than the later music did, which became more of like this 90s, as John calls it, 90s TV sensibility with more ambience, less motif and more melody.
Yeah. I mean, the music from Best of Both Worlds, which Ron Jones did, is excellent. Probably, I'd probably say the best music in the series. Mm-hmm. And take that from Encounter at Farpoint, which I'm not going to say it was the worst music in the series, nothing like that, but just it is much more of that 60s sensibility. And it's amazing to think of it being the same composer. And obviously the different producer brings in a different sensibility. One great thing is that you actually see the track names of each of the songs that were composed for it. And you might not know that The Naked Now had a song called Horny Doctor, or that Lonely Among Us had a song P for Picard.
Is that an order?
Right.
When the captain says go, you go.
Exactly.
And the bathroom's right over there, around the corner, right before you go into the conference room.
Right. I'm sure there's a manual doc joke to be made here.
But we will restrain ourselves.
We will.
All right.
But definitely people should go to Trek Movie and read John Shinoda's review. He goes into a lot more detail than we're able to here.
Absolutely. And we'll also have links in the show notes to that review and to the places where you can buy the set if you're interested. So salt vampires and cloud monsters are scary, but nothing is quite as frightening as giant space-fried eggs leaping on your back, and that's what happens to the crew, especially Spock, in Operation Annihilate! And today we're going to talk about this episode, as well as the IDW comic, which has reimagined the story, and other stories from the first season of TOS. And of course, I have Greg with me. And also joining us today, we have Sean Taranjo, and we also have John Tenuto. Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Great. So,
thanks.
Quick introduction of you guys. Now, John, you were actually just with me on MatterStream last week, I think. We were talking about the events you're doing this month about Ricardo Montalban and Khan. And I understand you just had the first Khan talk yesterday. How did that go?
Oh, it was great. We had a nice crowd of people, about 70 people at the library, and had a good time. We watched the episode Spacey together, and then took a look at the photos from Star Trek 2 and 6, and had a lot of great questions. And we brought our collectibles with us, all of our Khan and Spacey collectibles. And the biggest hit was a CED, the old precursor to Laserdiscs, in fact, from Space Seed. So that was great. People love seeing all those old things.
Wow, that sounds fun. Now, afterwards, you did not abandon the entire audience out in the parking lot and tell them that you'd come back and check on them next weekend, did you?
No, I did tell them at the end, though, that I was growing fatigued And I did it in my con voice. And,
nice.
Excellent.
Luckily, they got the joke, because otherwise it would have been a horrible ending.
Excellent. That's great.
You left a maroon on in a desert planet.
That's right. And Sean, many people know your work because you designed Captain Riker's ship, the USS Titan, which is now seen on the cover of the Titan books from Pocket Books.
Yep. And also, and it's actually a featured ship in Star Trek Online, too.
Oh, it is now. Nice. Oh, yeah. Excellent. Very, very nice. Oh, great. And it's a beautiful ship. It's interesting. How was that process of designing that for you?
Actually, that was the first time I actually designed a starship really seriously. I always doodled stuff, but the first time I actually did schematics and... usually I've entered contests before and was worried, oh, did I win? This time I was like, put it in and just let it be. Then when I got a call from Marco Palmieri, it's like my wife's watching me jump through the house, leaping up and down. Right. As she says, occasionally geekdom pays off.
Occasionally, that's right.
So, well, yeah, I can't believe it's already been 6 years. And in that time, it's been... put into the Star Trek Online game. It's been on the cover of the fourth book of the Titan series. Actually been commissioned by John Van Sitters for us. They have a Star Trek tour going around. Originally, they had a Titan attraction at the end with a six-foot model that was actually built by Gene Rosardi, who built the Titanic. And when they split the tour into two parts, they took it out, unfortunately.
Ah.
So... but yeah, that whole part, they actually filmed a whole scene with Tim Russ and Will Wheaton doing a battle scene, like they were being attacked while Riker was off the ship.
Oh, wow.
So,
oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. The whole thing is at the very end of the Star Trek tour, you have the six-foot version of the Titan popping out of a sphere, and it actually rotates and has lights going off on it where it's as it's being attacked. So.
Oh, wow, that's very cool.
Oh, that'd be really fantastic. Yeah, I was going to ask if you've had a chance to talk to Jonathan Frakes and see what he thinks of his ship.
Actually, there was about a year ago last, when Frakes was promoting one of his shows that he was directing, they had a contest of ask Jonathan a question, and he actually responded to my question and actually said he liked my ship. So.
Oh, nice. Very good.
So I'm still trying to get, I'm going to try to get it to the Vegas convention this year and maybe try to get a copy of the schematics to him, possibly. So I've been trying to get the last couple of years to try to get him an actual copy of the schematics. So no luck yet. But actually, Will Wheaton is the only one out of all the cast that actually sent me a congratulations email back when I won. So
great. That's very cool. Great.
Good or bad. I have nothing against Will, so.
No. Seems like a great guy.
Yeah. Not like Sheldon on Big Bang.
Right.
Well, it'll be nice if you get it to Star Trek Las Vegas. And one thing that I hope is not going to be at Star Trek Las Vegas are giant space amoebas filling the lobby, leaping on people's backs. So why don't we talk about Operation Annihilate a little bit? And I wanted to start by talking about the episode itself. It's one of those examples, I think, of the cheesiness of the original series, largely because of the giant fried eggs. But I read it one way when I watch it and I see all the visuals that are going on, and then when I only listen to the audio, which I often do for episodes, and I'm just listening to what the story concept is, it seems like it's kind of an interesting concept, the idea of this kind of mass insanity that's spreading through the galaxy and so forth. So I wanted to start by talking about the concept of Operation Annihilate versus the execution of Operation Annihilate about the episode itself. So, Greg, you haven't gotten a chance to say much yet. Right. So what is your first thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an extremely cheesy episode. And it's easy just to think of that up front as... pretty much all it is. I was watching it last night. I was watching it this morning. My roommate was also watching it with me, and she was just, it's hard not to just laugh every time they're on the planet. It looks like it's a time travel episode where they've gone to 1960s California. And B, yeah, there's these little rubber things everywhere. I think there's a point where one of the ensigns says that the creature effects are really bad in this episode, Captain. And have to kind of agree with her.
Don't they say something like, it doesn't look real?
Exactly.
Something like that.
This looks really fake. Seriously, no, Gene. Someone get Gene in here. This looks bad.
That wasn't in the script. That was just the actor improvising on the set, right?
Yeah, you're now instant no name. You're dead now. Standing out.
No more talking for you.
Yeah, so, you're dead.
But yeah, I think it's the first half is really kind of silly. The second half, I think, improves on it a lot, where you get into the whole deal with Spock being infected. And it's interesting, we're going to talk about the comic in a little bit, the deviation here, but it mostly focuses on Spock being affected, being cured and going blind, and then McCoy dealing with that. That becomes a quite interesting thing. And as far as the danger, it is a very interesting danger. And it's great that they made it so personal by having Spock be affected and not just have it be, oh, well, we have to fix this planet so that we can feel good about ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's one of the few episodes where, in fact, it may be the only episode I think I can recall where Kirk almost borders on forgetting his duty and his responsibilities because of that personal connection he has. You know, and you might be able to forgive him. He's lost a brother. He's lost a sister-in-law, and his nephew is in trouble, and Spock is in trouble. And so it becomes this really personal thing for him, and he has to make this switch or adjustment to going back to, and I think it's McCoy who sort of, you know, reminds him there's people down there, you know, this isn't just about you. And I can't recall another episode where he goes through that kind of experience.
True. And I also like how, especially the whole Spock thing, where how he makes it through all the pain is like, hit me.
Right.
It's like the whole thing. You find out more about the Vulcan physiology, the fact that they've got two sets of eyelids that are protect them from the desert. That's actually a good reflex. Like you think like an alligator, the membranes that go over their eyes when they're underwater.
Right.
And the whole fact that, yeah, he to embrace it and get himself through this, he has to get angry. That's why I actually love that part of the episode. The whole cheesiness of, I agree with about the cheesiness of the feels like a time travel episode when you're on the planet. And also the cheesy sound effects of those things when they were attacking too.
Yeah.
Oh, I do wish that Spock had Vulcans had two sets of eyebrows also, though, because that would be really cool.
They actually bring up the two sets of eyelids again in Enterprise. It's funny that comes up again, and we actually learned that was a small portion of the Vulcans that developed it, and then it ended up taking over the planet. So this isn't an episode you'd think that Enterprise would be going back and giving an homage to.
And that's a theme they use a lot, right, where Worf has redundant organs. That's how you get out of a medical emergency on Star Trek.
That's very true.
To have redundant organs.
I did like that they were saying, you know, the second pair of eyelids is like your appendix. I don't know. I think it's a little different from your appendix, but okay, Spock. You have a second pair of eyelids that protects you in the
from
case
going
of
blind.
Yeah.
Right.
We have a little piece of flesh inside of us that, you know, goes bad every once in a while.
Do they ever on Vulcan, do doctors perform like eyelid ectomies?
You don't need those anymore. I'm taking them away. You don't go out into the deep forge all too often.
That's right. Well, John, in the other side of the room, you mentioned an interesting thing here that the amoebas themselves are kind of like a precursor of the Borg, which we see later on in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. My son, who's 9, and I were watching the episode today, and my wife, and he was scared by the amoebas, but he hasn't. He's 9. I was scared too, I'm sure, when I watched it the first time. But when we were watching it, I was thinking about the fact that they really are, you know, the notion of the hive mind. They say the description of them is that they have, you know, they're sort of cell membranes of a larger brain. And, you know, individual components of a larger unit. And I was thinking how in the 60s that makes sense where, you know, technology was still kind of people's friend and the space program was becoming a reality and, you know, color TVs. And there wasn't that angst about technology that we sort of have today about how is it taking up too much of our lives. And the worst back then probably maybe was automation of jobs. But so it made sense that the fear would have been a biological fear, you know.
And also back then you also had the worry of the Russians with their biological warfare and the threat of nuclear war. So that was more present back then than what we have now to worry about technology taking over our lives.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like that invasion of the body snatchers, you know, the who can you trust, who can't you trust, who has within them, you know, the Russian spy and who has, or the amoeba. But in the 80s, I think globalization and technology, we start to fear that loss of identity. So it's really the same villain in a way, except we add the biological and the technological components together.
Very interesting. I felt like it was an interesting concept to have them. I guess they're called blastoneurons or something in the Starfleet Medical Encyclopedia. But I felt like it was never paid off that they were this hive mind. Like, supposedly that's how they're able to withstand the phasers and stuff. But it never really goes anywhere. And I don't feel like they come across as a real threat. I feel like that could have been a lot stronger. There have been episodes, I feel like, of, say, Voyager, where someone's mind was being taken over and you sort of got the idea of this villain through our main characters, where Spock just sort of tries to take over the ship, fails, and then he overcomes it. How did you think that that was handled with them being a hive mind and the blastoneurons as villains?
I don't know. I guess I agree with you that it was never really fully realized. You know, they talked about it and the concept was interesting. But unlike the Borg, who were developed, you know, over the course of the Next Generation and then into Voyager, I mean, we only see these creatures once. Yeah. And so there's not really an opportunity to explore that. But I do agree, you know, with what John's saying about it being a similarity.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and they're similar in a way also to the parasites from Conspiracy, I feel like, in that they are able to sort of grab onto you and control you. And it's an interesting idea. And again, the way that they made it be so personal with Spock is really interesting. Another missed opportunity I felt like was having Kirk's brother show up. Now, we were saying that, yes, Kirk sort of forgets his duties, but that turnaround, it happens really fast, that he is back on point, and, you know, he gets to the end of the episode, and it's, you know, we're having a laugh on the bridge again. I did want to have some sort of further impact on Kirk from losing his brother. There's even another point, is it a movie where Kirk says, I lost a brother once, or I had a brother once, and he's referring to Spock. I believe, is at least the implication that everyone comes away with. And he's not talking about his brother, who apparently is this real person that meant something to him, according to the episode.
Well, that's a good point I wanted to ask you guys about. I don't want to get too far into the comic yet, but one difference between, and we should say, spoiler alert to anyone who is planning to read the comics who hasn't read them yet, we are going to talk about what happened in this comic and some of the other comics during this feature. So if you do want to read them, you might want to grab them, come back and finish the feature later. But so in the comic version of Operation Annihilate, Kirk's brother lives, but in the episode, he dies. And so the question is, in wondering why they're exploring certain episodes in the comic, how will that impact Kirk's life? We already know in the movie, the J.J. Abrams movie, Kirk's father dies at the time that Kirk is born. So that's influenced how Kirk's life has developed from that point forward versus the prime timeline Kirk. Now, here we have a case where Kirk's brother dies in the original series, but lives in the alternate universe of the Abramsverse. So just talking about the episode, do you feel that there was at any point through the remainder of the original series or the movies that the death of Kirk's brother affected how he approached his duty or how he interacted with his crew?
I feel like they sort of washed over it. There's sort of his brother died, moved on, and he's got a nephew still around, but they never really explore him anymore. And that's where going into, I'm a fan of a lot of the like a phase two fan stuff that's been on New Voyagers. I like how they actually brought that character as a member of Kirk's crew. And you get to see how, he's actually one of the sub characters on New Voyagers. And you see how they react with each other. Yeah. So that's, I wish they would have done that. And you actually get to see how he, it really affected him. The fact that, that his brother is no longer there to raise his nephew. Mm-hmm. And then that's where, then like what you said, back in the movie, he had a brother once. They just started glossed over it. And that's where they referred as basically Spock being his brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and hopefully in the way they're doing it in the comic book now, granted the animosity between the Kirk has for his brother leaving, which you saw in the beginning of in the cutscenes of the JJ verse, you never really knew for sure that that was his brother walking around the road, unless you saw the comic adaptation or the cutscenes. And he really held a lot of animosity for his brother upping and leaving him there with his uncle. And or his mom step whoever I think it was his uncle wasn't it that he was living in Iowa. His
according to brother. This comic, yeah, it's his uncle. I think originally there was a stepfather of some sort.
Yeah,
but yeah, they moved that, so he's living with his uncle. And I guess George left. But I mean, how did that exactly work? Is anyone clear on this timeline? Because his older brother isn't that much older. Like, where did he go? Did he just hitchhike off into the sunset?
Yeah, they sort of left it at that.
I think he went to Illinois.
Yeah. Just kept on walking.
John, you have delved more into the various drafts of the scripts of the movies than most people have. You know, you've in your research into archives. Is there anything that never made it to screen that you've discovered or references to, you know, how this could have affected Kirk at any point? Or is it just something that's was kind of ignored from this point forward?
Well, they did film a scene at the end that wasn't included. In fact, Peter Kirk is in the chair, and Kirk is kneeling down talking to him and saying, you know, do you want to live with your grandmother or your grandparents back on Earth? And he says no, he wants to stay on the planet because his father loved that planet, and he's going to live with his father's business partner and their family who never had children. And Kirk gives him a hug or whatever, and he kind of goes off. And then Scotty says something like, he'll be a fine lad, and maybe he'll get into Starfleet one day. And Kirk says, I hope not. I don't want him to have to make the kind of decision I had to make, to kill all those people. So they did film that. There is a couple photos floating around here and there of Peter in the, you know, he's in a little Starfleet outfit, you know, little yellow command shirt. There is that photo that's sort of floating around out there, and they did film that scene, but they went with a different ending. They cut that out, and then just for time, I think. And so that would have been, that could have set up a theme where you could have looked at future episodes maybe and looked at Kirk struggling in those kinds of decisions that he has to make. With Star Trek V, I know there was some adaptations that included the line, I lost two brothers, and I'm lucky I got one of them back. But I think the reason they didn't include that was just the, you know, the generic audience. Are they going to remember that? And I think the way they filmed it was okay, because the look that McCoy gave, I always interpreted as expecting him to talk about George / Sam, you know, depending on which version you want to go with, you know, his first or middle name. And he kind of gives him a weird look. Like, I mean, he does remember that Spock died. I mean, he had his Katra. So he shouldn't be confused where Kirk's going. But he does look sort of confused. And I wonder if they added that as sort of a little nod to those of us who would know, like, hey, wait a second. Don't you care about your brother? So yeah, I think the Kirk, there's a lot of confusion in the movie. If you look at the credits, Frank is listed as stepdad and George is listed as Johnny, because that was such a last minute change. And he says Johnny and when he's going past him, and then now, but in the comic, that's George, although they don't clarify that that's George walking down the road, but now Frank is the uncle. And I know because I believe Dominic Keating had tried out for that role, and it went to an actor named Brad William Henke, I think his name is, who winds up playing him in the deleted scenes. And then Greg Grunberg does the voiceover when they change it all in the film. So, I mean, there's a lot of sort of confusion of, you know, and I always wondered in the film, I thought it was a mistake that we never knew what happened to his mother. You know, where is Winona? Is she around? And I think having him named Sam in the prime timeline, you know, in this episode is also, you know, it adds to that whole confusion about Kirk's family and who is George. And, but I guess it makes sense in the prime universe, right? If his name is George Samuel Kirk and his dad's name is George Kirk, that they might've called him Sam if the father survived, you know.
Right.
But did they make that change later because he's George in this universe, you know, in the Abrams universe, so, and he's Sam in the episode. So that all just makes it even more confusing.
I feel like without the writer's strike, that whole thing would have been fixed, you know, at the script level. Yeah. They sort of made these last minute choices because they cut so much from the opening of the film. I think the opening was running long, what with all of the scenes with Winona Ryder and Spock as a kid, and then these scenes with Kirk as a kid, and they were just saying, you know, we really need to get to the story, make sure this movie doesn't run 3 hours long. And there wasn't a really good way to gloss over certain elements, like, you know, I guess they couldn't really cut him passing the kid on the road, so they sort of dubbed in Johnny. They couldn't cut somebody yelling at him over the phone, but it doesn't work at all. If I did my own edit, I think I would just cut out that entire Iowa scene because it doesn't really work, you know, in the film that they actually made, because they cut out so much of the important family drama stuff. The stuff they left in is just like, well, why is he driving this Corvette? It doesn't really work. And you don't need it to set up who Kirk is, because once you meet Chris Pine, you're like, okay, well, that's who Kirk is.
Yeah. And also they set up perfectly in the bar that he was a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you didn't need to show, theoretically, they wanted to show that Kirk and Spock are that close in age, but they didn't need to really show the fact that he was a troublemaker even always that young of an age by stealing a car.
Right.
Yeah.
I think they just wanted to throw in a nice little cool effect of a flying police car and so they can throw in some Aerosmith.
That's probably it.
I always wondered if they had the song playing Sabotage because of Shatner, that famous sound, you know, is that a little nod to Shatner with Sabotage.
Yeah.
I think JJ has said specifically that it's not, but I don't believe him is basically what I've come down on. It has to be a reference. And if it's not, it's one of the greatest coincidences in Star Trek history.
Right. I side with you.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the comic versus the episode. Now, we already talked about the fact one of the biggest changes, of course, is that George / Sam Kirk lives at the end. And what else stands out to you, the deviations in this comic from this version to the original episode?
I'd say right off the bat, it makes such a huge difference, as I said when we talked about the comic in the past, the production design, you know, the fact that the city actually looks like an alien planet, the fried eggs are now, yes, the tentacle gumdrops. And it makes such a bigger difference. The scenes are more dynamic. They have a, you know, quote, bigger budget to have these crowd scenes. And it's what you feel like the show would have been if they'd had the money. And it's amazing what a difference that money makes, taking basically the same story, especially for the first half of the script or so, just changing it over, having it feel bigger, it really adds to what the episode is, makes it much more serious.
And I also like the fact that they, the very first like four pages or five pages of it is a actual flashback where you see what happened to his brother, how Winona addressed it. And then it shows, ends up with Kirk just sitting up on his roof looking at the stars.
Yeah, I think this is the first comic that they've done in this line where they kind of got it right in many ways. I think, you know, they deserve a little growing room too. And I mean, shows need some episodes to get their footing, but I thought the first four issues were a little too close to the original episode. Yeah. And then they do one little change and it would be at the end and you knew that there would be this change. But this one, they really changed a lot from the episode. I think they switched the story is personal and it stays personal, unlike the episode where it's personal and then it goes back to the duty of how do I save these people, where Kirk is almost not involved at all in the story of solving the problem. It is all Kirk. It's all McCoy, Spock, and Scotty, and you don't really see much of Scotty. Even that's sort of dealt with as a side issue. So the whole planet becomes a B story, and they're much more focused on that personal story. Although one of the things I wish they would do in the comics, just as a little nod to Jimmy Doohan, is the episode is one of those great episodes where he's hiding his hand, you know, because in real life he lost his finger during the war, and I don't think they're going to go that route, but I always like watching it. In this episode, it's really obvious that he's hiding his hand, and I was hoping that they'd do something like that as a little nod. I guess that's too inside of a thing, but Scotty's almost completely, I mean, I think there's one or two panels of him, and it's really off. He's off the page in this script, and I think that's because they really wanted to focus on George and Kirk and their relationship with each other.
And I'm just looking through the issue right now, and the whole fact that they're trying in the original episode, you didn't really have a big escape scene, and this whole escaping through the whole undergrounds, and they finally they're running out of room, and all of a sudden his brother shows up and saves his ass at the at the very last second, and it's sort of like the old dun dun dun.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
The great act down. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that they gave the female landing party red shirt something more to do than just record. I mean, I think that's all her function was.
Yeah.
She was a yeoman recording in the episode. In this one, she has a name, Zara, and she, you know.
Is that actually a security officer?
Yeah, she actually helped save them, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I think at least in the credits, now, I think she had the name Zara in the episode. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if they ever actually said it. And, but yeah, the original actress was a model who I think was a Star Trek fan and wanted to be in Star Trek and like got herself in the episode. But when you're...
It's like, her name is like Mariska or something.
Yeah,
it's,
Mariska.
It's very one-word model name.
Yeah, yeah. You have Iman in Star Trek VI. You have Mariska in Operation Annihilate. But you're right, John. It's like they're on the planet and they're... It's like, I think, is it Spock? He's doing the tricorder to examine the amoeba. And then she's right behind him. It's like she's writing down every... It's like a doctor taking notes or something.
Yeah, I think Kirk says the line to her, I want everything recorded. And it's like, when did they start doing that, you know?
I just picture every landing party, you've got a yeoman walking around with you, just writing down everything that happens, just in case they want to turn it into a story or a movie or an episode later on, you know, Starfleet movie productions.
A hollow novel later.
I will note that my roommate was noticing that there are a lot of hot women in the original series. So
yes, there are.
It's not like their effort went unnoticed, and which is probably 90% of the reason that she was there at all.
I'm wondering why Uhura wears that belt. I don't know if you noticed that. She has on, I think it's the only episode where she has on a belt on the bridge. She has a belt on away missions. But I did she just come back from it? Was she supposed to be the one going on there? And that was a last-minute casting, and that was Uhura's role initially. And
it's quite possible
they forgot that during the costuming or something like that. And because it's a weird belt.
I did note that in the comic, Uhura is not wearing much at all during a couple pages. That wouldn't have shown up on 60s TV, you know. Definitely. No. So I mean, here's they want every single episode or every single issue to show how Spock and Uhura's relationship changed the episode. I want to talk a little bit about that. Chris and I were joking on iMessage while we were watching the show. What were you saying? That Uhura should have tried to hug Spock to fix it?
Yeah, I think you
fix it.
McCoy said, I've tried this and I've tried that and nothing works. And then I said, have you tried a hug?
But we do have this very interesting scene. I think we talked a little bit before, but where Uhura is sort of calling Spock on how he's taking chances, and he's not acting like the Spock we know and love. I want to know what you guys really thought of that.
Well, I thought that was a little derivative of B'Elanna. You know, I mean, there's always going to be derivatives with 800 episodes, but I guess it's reasonable that he would he's going to have some kind of reaction, you know, but it doesn't seem to make sense to me that reaction would manifest itself into him kind of wanting to die. In fact, I would think it would be the opposite in the sense, in terms of logic, that he would want to maybe stop taking risks because there's so few Vulcans left, which I think would have been a more interesting choice.
Either that, or he's trying to embrace the humanity in his physiologically. Since Vulcan, yeah, his Vulcan size there, but he's now more embracing his mom's home planet. His mom's dead in this universe. His planet's dead in this universe, and Earth is all that's left, really. And now he's sort of, he doesn't really know how to embrace that, so he's taken, I think he's just, that's why he's taking more emotional risks. And maybe not consciously, but subconsciously, that's playing at his personality.
Well, we also see in the comic version of Galileo 7 that he's going to jump out of the ship to save everybody. He's going to sacrifice himself as well in that case.
Yeah.
Right, which raises an issue whether that's, I mean, is that part of the setup for the film? Is this going to be one of his arcs in the movie?
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I'm sure they're at least setting up the next two issues, which, as have already been revealed in press releases and such, that it's going to be a Vulcan arc for the next two episodes or issues, not based on original episode. So you guys think they're at least setting up that, right? That we're going to see how Spock is really dealing with it and his interaction with the rest of Vulcan as pertains to the revenge that I'm sure some Vulcans feel against the Romulans, against whoever's involved. I wonder how Spock is going to react to all that.
Which is an interesting character twist, because in some ways you get the idea that Spock feels like an outcast in the original show from Vulcan. You know, certainly I think the relationship with his father it creates an estrangement in him. Where in the Abrams universe and in the comic books, it seems to be that, you know, he's taking this, that he had more of a connection to that world. And, you know, did he have an estrangement with his father over going into Starfleet? Maybe not in this Abrams universe, and therefore he's more connected to the planet and to the culture and to the people. I mean, you do have that scene where he kind of gives the elders the chastised version of live long and prosper, but it seems like he's more connected to being Vulcan, the Quinto version versus the Nimoy version.
I feel like the main difference between as pertains to its relationship with his dad is in the original series, Spock believed that Sarek never loved Amanda, that it was this, he just did it for the diplomacy. And as a result of Amanda's death, Sarek reveals to Spock that he did love her. And I really think that's going to be a huge part. And I think that's going to bring Spock and Sarek closer together in the coming movies. And I think that's why he and Uhura are still together. And that's why he didn't basically stop that, because he realized even as a Vulcan, his father was able to love a human. And, you know, he's, you know, half human. I think he's more willing to embrace his human side because his father was accepting of his human side, and his father had these feelings as well and admitted to it.
Yeah, his father, which this goes by the different actors who played his father. Mark Leonard was very stoic. Mm-hmm. And the way he came across as Sarek, he's very unmoving. And the J.J. Sarek, he shows that he actually is vulnerable. He lost the love of his life, that he doesn't really didn't show it, but they had at least he had the wherewithal to admit to his son that, yes, I loved your mother. She's gone, and we must embrace the fact that there was that love. Where even in the TNG episodes where Sarek, you saw his the wives after Amanda, they was more of a stoic relationship versus the the more showing a little bit more emotion that you see in the JJ's verse.
Yeah.
Spock does seem to have a preference for human women, even in the original show. I always thought there was some, there was certainly an affinity between Uhura and Spock in the original show. There are little moments, you know, I believe she would even touch his arm. And I remember the moment where he complimented her about her work when they're sort of, she's trying to fix the circuitry. And, you know, he, there's little moments like that where he has with her that he doesn't have. I think he sees her as a kindred spirit. And, but if you look at his relationships in the original show, it seems to be with human females and like human looking females.
Like with Chapel. The tension between Chapel and Spock was just that's one of the favorite things about the original series, and that's one of the reasons why I like Michelle Barrett so much, just the way she her looking over and then sort of the Spock reacting to it. And IDW sort of touched back on that when the Spock miniseries where he was reflecting, and it's like there's this scene where right that takes place during motion picture where they meet up in the turbo lift, and they're trying to communicate but not, and then he sort of acknowledges hope you're okay kind of a moment when she leaves the turbo lift, and he congratulates her on her becoming a doctor. So that some of those relationships I would have loved to see more going on, Spock showing that kind of stuff. That's why one of the reasons I actually do like Quinto's betrayal. I'm thinking it didn't happen in the Prime timeline, because Spock was more, at least because of when he showed up on the Pike Enterprise, he was more embracing his Vulcan side, didn't know how to interact with humans. He was having trouble communicating how a lot of you could see the tension between the human crew versus Spock, just the way he would think about things. So I don't think that the Uhura and him even were in contact in the Prime timeline.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am too. I don't think that they were in contact. I feel like in the JJ movie, they have put Spock's age closer to the rest of the crew than it was in the Prime timeline. I always felt Spock was much older than everyone else in the original timeline. Now, I think that the Spock Uhura relationship is not totally pulled out of thin air. You know, there are, like John was talking about, those little moments in the original series, and even early in the series, there are obvious moments where Uhura is flirting with Spock in some of the early episodes. So the fact
it's like
that
when she's singing and he's playing the Vulcan guitar or whatever, just the looks that they're giving with each other and going back and forth. And
there's that. There are moments on the bridge as well where she's flirting with him. And so a lot of fans are upset about the relationship, but I think that the writers saw those little moments and decided to run with it and make a relationship in this timeline. So that part works okay for me. Oh, God.
Yeah.
that really was just out of the blue.
I don't mind the relationship. I think it's interesting. What I don't want to see is a lot of it, because I think... To me, I mean, I'm actually, in terms of the IDW comics, this crossover with the Legion, I think is badly written in many ways. But the most egregious problem, I think, is the way that they've handled Kirk, where he's constantly hitting on one of the other characters. I've never bought the argument that Kirk was a Lothario. If you really look at the original show, he wasn't. He was always respectful of women. He loved women. Certainly he was romantic. But he treated the female members of his crew as professionals. If anything, he maybe tried to protect them a little bit in that 60s bravado, but he was never sexual with his crew. I think there was something between him and Helen Noel maybe at a party that isn't specified if they were on the Enterprise together at that time. And I just kind of like that they didn't get into those kinds of inter-character romances, because I always thought that it's sort of inappropriate for the captain, certainly, and probably for the first officer. You know, and I don't think Kirk would do that, and I don't think Spock would do that in terms of, the appropriateness of their command. And I think, when Kirk does kind of go with the alien of the week, it's often for a purpose. You know, there's a reason he's doing it. And how do you get the
phaser out of her belt?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to make the joke about him being Lothario or something, but I think that he's much more of a, he's no James Bond, let's put it that way.
No.
And I think that in some ways it seems odd that, you know, because it doesn't seem like they're on a mission. I don't know if in the next movie they're going to be on a 5-year mission or not, and away from the Academy, from Starfleet or not. But it seems to me, since they're kind of going back and forth to Earth a lot, because I don't think the warp works the same in the movies either. It seems to be like, they're more like warp tunnels where it's very fast to get from one place to another. I mean, they go back and forth.
It does seem like it, yeah.
It's more like Star
seconds.
Wars than
yeah,
Star Trek.
Yeah, much more.
The way they travel.
And that's okay if they've developed this new technology because of the alternate history. But I think with that in mind, if they really are going back and forth to Earth all the time and they're not on a 5-year mission, it's even more inappropriate, because you could argue 5 years away from home, you need to have human interaction. But if you're going home all the time, you can see your wife or son or daughter or husband every couple of weeks. It seems like you could come back, and it's more like an Alaskan fishing vessel, you know, than it is a starship. And it just seems odd, I think, in some ways, for that reason, to have that relationship. And in the comics, it just seems it humanizes him in a way that I think is in a way that diminishes the character when they're physically together. In this comic, it bothers me a little bit, because part of me is like, I still don't understand that 7-year cycle then.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it doesn't have to be 7 years.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
if
it doesn't
she's
have
really
to
hot,
be.
And like Roxine.
Right. I mean,
that's
it's more
what
like,
I...
It's that's more like the I Enterprise actually... to Paul. It's more like the Enterprise to Paul presentation where they would have relationships or whatever. But it demystifies characters when they have them on normal human.
Well, that's why I want them to actually maybe explore that whole, the Pong Far, going back with the Ston and everything. Is Ston still there? Is still T'Pren or whatever, is Betrobe still alive?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see them actually touch up on that and see how Uhura is affected by the fact that he was actually betrothed to somebody else. That would be kind of interesting to see. And another thing I like with the relationship between Kirk, Spock, and Uhura is that the whole fact that Uhura has some cojones in this universe. And she's actually, she does not like Kirk just from the get-go, just because of his bravado from the... I want to see how that, their working relationship would actually advances, and how they can get on a common ground where they have a common understanding of each other. Because even now, even in the comic, you still see Kirk and Uhura having a little tit for tat on the bridge. Mm-hmm. Just the way he has to stand up for her, especially in the Galileo 7 when she takes off and with the shuttle. He sort of covers it up, but he's like, I would have done the same thing. So I want to see that kind of see what they do there versus in the Prime universe, Uhura is always sort of, I think, lusting after Kirk. Because you saw it more often. Because, granted, yes, you had the original interracial kiss and all that stuff, but you saw how in the original series, especially like with Mirror Mirror, she was afraid, and so she would always look to Kirk for that moral support. And in this JJ universe, she's more of a stand on her own person. She's not going to take any guff from anybody.
Well, I think part of the change to this in the universe is, in the original series, I think everyone was kind of in love with Kirk. You know, Uhura was, Spock was, McCoy to some extent.
Okay, Greg, let's not get into all that that fan fiction and stuff that we find on Google here.
No, but they were. Everyone looked up to Kirk. He was the Adama of the Enterprise.
So say we all.
Yeah.
And
he was the youngest captain of that era. He's still the youngest captain in this universe.
Well, but now he's so young, And there is that animosity from Uhura. McCoy is so much more experienced than he is. I feel like he isn't going to be as respected. He's going to have to prove himself much more. He's going to have to develop that relationship. All those things that were sort of assumed in the original series, Pineskirk is going to have to actually get to it and prove why he should be, you know, thought of in the history books.
Yeah.
And that's going to be really fascinating to see, especially in the next film.
So let's talk about, as our final topic here, where we've talked about it a bit so far, but really delve into clues in the comics then and where these comics may be leading, because the comics, they're being produced by IDW, but Roberto Orsi is like the creative director or creative consultant, I think is his actual title, but he and Bad Robot are involved in this. And they have said not only that that these comics are leading into the next movie, I think Michael Johnson, who's the writer, I believe, came out and said a while back that there is a clue in the first comic to the subplot of the new movie. And I see one thing in the first comic, which I think is an indication of something we might see in the next movie. But I wanted to ask you guys, in reading these, what have you noticed in the comics that might be clues to the path that we're on and what we might see?
Well, I was thinking about, part of it was thinking of the design aspect that we didn't really see a lot of the ship in the first film. And I know with the bigger budget that they have on this film that there are plans to do, they've said that there's plans to do, to see more of the ship. And so I would imagine with the amount of control that the Bad Robot has, that they wouldn't allow IDW to create sets that weren't modeled on what they're actually going to look like. So I this is just my opinion, of course, but I really believe we've seen the conference room as it's going to appear in the movie. And it's much more next gen. You know, it's got the windows. I mean, I think there's going to be more windows on this ship, and that's maybe a bit of the TNG fans that Roberto Orsi is, and just the fact that they have a budget now that they didn't have on the original show, in which case you couldn't have, you know, visuals of the outside of the ship too often.
My thing is, are they going to switch the, which bugged the heck out of me with the sets, the whole brewery of the engine room? That's my main nitpick about the whole ship, interior of the ship. I did not like the fact that the interior is just all the brewery.
Which is interesting, because I don't think we've really seen too much of that set in the comic.
Yeah.
So I think that there are, you know, we've seen a little bit of Spock's quarters now, more of Uhura in Spock's quarters than the quarters themselves. but you see that there's windows, you know, which is just a very TNG look. I think there's that clues. And then I'm also looking at like which characters are popping up, which ones are being mentioned. And I would say I'd bet, you know, some of my toys on the fact that Keenzer is going to be in this film, because he just always is. He's behind.
He's always behind Scotty.
Yeah, if they didn't like that character, they would have just left him out of the comic and moved on.
And I love the actor who plays him.
Oh, yeah.
He's been around so many films, and he always brings so much to the character that he plays, and I love it.
Yeah.
So I hope they bring more into him.
Wasn't he the Oompa Loompas, Deep Roy, but in the new Willy Wonka? I love that.
Yeah.
I think, actually, didn't they film... Originally, he was supposed to stay on the ice planet, but then they filmed a scene of him in the uniform with Scotty to sort of stick in the end, because, everyone did kind of love that character. Be interesting. I hope he gets some character development. I mean, he's pretty much the one character in the film out of so many characters that we learn nothing about. At least we get tiny bits of info about even Chekhov and Sulu. Keenzer, we get nothing other than what he looks like. So I hope we get little bit more.
He can eat a little pea and be done for fine for a week.
There you go. Put that in the Starfleet Encyclopedia.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you now. In the first comic, what I see is the clue, as we're talking about characters here.
Mm-hmm.
We know Alice Eve has been cast, but we don't know who Alice Eve is playing at this point. And there are two things that stand out to me. That's what I think, yeah. There are two things that stand out to me in the first comic. The first is that Daner is not in the story, and therefore she did not die. And so she's still around. And they also have this kind of throwaway line where they imply that Daner and McCoy had some kind of past relationship.
Yeah, that's why she didn't want to be caught dead on the Enterprise with him.
Right.
So I suspect that Alice Eve is playing Daner, and Daner is going to be on the ship, although the story is not going to be anything related to Where No Man Has Gone Before, but Daner's going to be there. Or the other option is that she's playing Rand, because in the Galileo 7 comic, suddenly Rand is back, who was supposed to be in the original episode, but of course she got booted off the show at that point. But I like the line in the comic where they look at her and go, Yeoman Rand? Like with a question mark. And I don't know, is that, are you asking, are you okay? Are you like, you're surprised to see her sitting there?
Right.
Yeah. But I also, when I was first picked up that comic, it's like, okay, if Rand's here, they're going to kill her. But then she actually ends up surviving the whole episode. Yeah. So it's just... So Rand's actually one of my favorite characters through that first season.
What do you think about the Daner hypothesis?
Well, I think that's a great hypothesis. Part of it would be if they decided to go, you know, they didn't give Kirk a romance in the first film. And I think, you know, maybe they're going to go that route again and not go the obvious route of a romance for him. And rather it would be McCoy who has the romance. And
maybe they're
going to do something with that. I think that that could be an interesting setup. In terms of how I think Hollywood works and the mentality and the creativity plus the non-creativity, I'm personally leaning that she's Carol Marcus and Cumberbatch.
Oh, that's actually a good idea.
But I don't know anything, in terms of any details or anything like that. In the comics, there certainly is no mention of Carol Marcus. So there hasn't been any mention of Khan or Space Seed or anything like that, the Botany Bay, eugenics, nothing. So there's no clue in the comic that would point to that. And if the comics are a clue to that, then that theory is not a reasonable theory. And I also think there's some problem. If Cumberbatch is Khan, then they've got some explaining to do in terms of how he radically changed. So it may not be Carol Marcus, it may not be Khan, and if it isn't Carol Marcus, I would think that Elizabeth Daner is probably the very best bet.
And then from the spy photos that come out where they're all ticked off now, that fight scene with Quinto and the villain, it doesn't look like it's a eugenics kind of person. So because it looks like it's a the same kind of uniform that Kirk wore throughout that first movie. So I think it's going to be something that's totally away from the Khan and the Botany Bay, which is fine for me because Khan's my all-time favorite villain, like everybody else. But it just they really pay a good homage to Ricardo Montalban, I would stay away from touching Khan again.
Well, what do you think of them doing Khan in the comics? You know, at some point leading up to the next movie, just go ahead and do Khan, get it over with, and move on.
That actually, if they did, because then you could see a little bit. I would like to see a little bit more of since in the original one, the whole thing was Chekhov and Khan never met.
Right.
I would love to see Chekhov and Khan meeting up in the hallway or something like
That'd be great. Yeah.
Yeah, just that kind of a thing, because Ricardo Montalban used to say, "Yeah, we met in the bathroom." Right.
Another reason I wonder if it's that it might be Daner too is that Rand, would they have her reveal be in the comic, you know? Or would they keep that as a surprise for the movie? You know what I mean?
Hmm.
So it may not be Rand. I mean, it's a lot of the signs do point to.
Or it could be, of course, you only saw her in one episode, is like Moreau's character. Kirk sort of had that, the captain's woman from Mirror Mirror, and you met up, you only saw her on the prime. You never know, it might be like a Moreau character.
Yeah, but I do feel like they've gone to great lengths in their casting to try to find actors and actresses who look very similar to the original characters.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I really feel like Daner is the, especially because of the McCoy thing, I think she's the spot on, absolutely going to happen. But just like with Carol Marcus, I don't, as we said with Daner, doesn't have to be the Where No Man Has Gone Before storyline. I think even if it's Carol Marcus or even if she shows up, doesn't mean it has to be a con story. We can still see Carol Marcus, still see their relationship.
Right, because
and
Kirk had
all
a
the other things don't have to go along with it.
With her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
True.
Right. I mean, because he had to have known her.
Yeah.
At about that time, right? Mm-hmm. If we were going with that.
And the thing is, are they going to do that? Would they? So they. Who says there's even going to be a David in this universe?
Mm-hmm.
So, because it's so radically different with him, with the diversions. But if it's the Carol Marcus, that would be a good way to bring off with her sort of leaving him to find out, yeah, she's pregnant. I don't want to have you in my life because I don't want him living that life. Kind of a take on the story. Mm-hmm. Then you can actually see but the Daner, I think it'd be more likely because of the McCoy. McCoy subplot.
It could be Ruth, I suppose, too. From again, I don't know. They haven't. Can't recall any clues that would point to that. I mean, it could be Ruth from Shore Leave, who Kirk has a great affinity for.
Yeah,
and would have known around that time, I suppose.
Well, because they've said that there is a clue in the first comic to the subplot, is there anything besides this that you saw in the first comic that you think could be that clue?
Well, I don't. That's the difficult part of it. I guess I'm thinking of blonde women like Kirk has been right. Presuming they're going to keep her hair that same color, you know, it could be the doctor from Deadly Years too. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities, you know, in terms of the timing of all of that and the ages and that sort of thing. You know, I was thinking that the idea that you know, this reckless Spock idea, and also this idea of Kirk having to learn his job. I think you see a lot of that in that first issue when they redo the Gary Mitchell storyline, where Kirk is really feeling his way. And I think maybe one of the clues may be that the setting of this. So, I mean, if these adventures are all occurring, you know, because part of the question is the next film the next day, or is the next film a year from now, 5 years from now? What's the time passage between 2009? And are they going to keep it in real time and it's going to be 4 years or whatever? And I think if you look at the comic and I'm trying to place some of this, it seems to me like it might be like a year or two, you know? So it isn't going to be the next day, I don't think. Because then that would make these adventures would all be after the fact, which wouldn't make any sense.
Because I personally wanted to see more. Granted, I wanted to see Mitchell. I wanted to see where he was in this universe. And then, of course, having the first storyline being the whole the Mitchell storyline is sort of threw me for, okay, so they're not going to do that in the next film.
Yeah.
Which is why I don't think Cumberbatch in any way could be Mitchell. I mean, that would have been a possibility. If the comic didn't come out, I might have voted for that being Mitchell.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're going to contradict. They're not going to. I don't think they are, that they would contradict the comic.
Oh, it would defeat the entire purpose of the comics if they contradicted it at all. So
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if the movie isn't going to be a lot later, like, just after the 5-year mission, and just sort of have the comics even continuing still be stories within the 5-year mission, and have the next movie be post and see what happens at that point. Which, I mean, we start coming up on the Klingon War, which I'm sure in the background that there's still conflict with the Klingons and the Federation building. So that's a direction the film series could even go in that would be interesting if they went ahead and moved on through the chronology.
That would be interesting too, because then it would move away. You know, my fear with any sequel is the Wayne World effect, where the second film is the first film.
Yeah.
And they regress the characters back, and they have the same arcs and that kind of thing. And so if they are setting it 5 years, 6 years, 7 years down the road, they're still in the same uniform. So that might point to it being closer, but if they're, you know, if they keep the uniforms for a long period of time, unlike the sort of the spin-offs where they changed quite a bit.
Right.
But if they kept the uniforms and that's not any kind of an indication of timeline, then it would be nice, because it would move Kirk past the character arc of being inexperienced, and maybe they're playing that out in the comic for us
Right.
So that in the film, we can see a more established captain.
Yeah, because I'm just flipping through the first issue now, and the only kind of things I can see as a teaser would be coming back and revisiting the Valiant storyline, Denner, or actually more with the that little the little engineer guy. Kinsler, sorry.
That's about what you see, yeah.
Yeah, because when I flip it through, because all of that's just interaction. It's the first half of the episode.
Yeah, yeah.
So well, I'm thinking it's probably going to be the Denner storyline.
Yeah. Well, have there been anything in the subsequent comics that have stood out to you that might be clues? Things that really stood out, like, hey, here's something where I think that they are setting us up.
Well, the fact that Rand's back on the... I'm thinking that character to be brought back because she's there. Where she wasn't there. Also, she's got the last time you saw her was in that in the first season. All of a sudden, next time you see her is in the transporter room of the motion picture, where the people are dying in the transporter. So,
I don't expect her to be a big character, but I do expect that she'll be there. I see an interesting dynamic between Chekhov and Kirk appearing, especially in these episodes. I feel like they're trying to interject him in scenes where he wasn't before. But it'll be good to see that, too, in the next film, to see Chekhov sort of coming out and all the characters knowing him rather than in the original series, he wasn't there at all for the first season. And then in the first movie, he's just this guy who's just there.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, in the Galileo 7 comics, that this through line of, you know, I'm a little fuzzy on exactly how experienced the new Spock is. I mean, he's obviously a first officer and he's a teacher at the academy. That's a seems to be an awful lot for even a Vulcan if he is a similar age as Kirk. But he may have, does he have 10 years? It's possible he has 10 years experience in. In which case, then Galileo 7 plays weird because I always took the original episode to be this is sort of Kirk's Spock's first kind of command crisis decision, which is odd considering that he would have served with Pike and was first officer, who eventually was first officer for Kirk anyway, and was second officer for Pike. And the fuzziness of that is a bit troubling. Trying to figure out how experienced is this new Spock. So I wonder if at least that is a part, if the film is set closer to the original film, the sequel, I wonder if they're going to play any of this inexperience of Kirk or inexperience of Spock and literally the kids getting the keys to the car and to see how do they handle the car once they're driving it.
Especially if they're going to bring Bruce Greenwood's Pike back into it. See if he has to pull Kirk's tail out of a fire.
He's
confirmed in it.
I'm kind of expecting just more of a cameo, though, personally.
Yeah.
Because
I'm hoping he won't be like the Admiral. Was it Galileo 7 where he sort of just stay in the background reminding Kirk what time it is?
Oh, intergalactic walking timepiece. Yeah.
Yes. Ferris. Yeah. So maybe Pike will do that. But it is, as you say, the kids getting the car keys. This is an entire ship, at least an entire bridge, full of kids. Yeah. And I hope they do something with that and acknowledge it or bring someone in with some more experience. I mean, because it is a little crazy that this is the flagship of the Federation.
That's what I was going to say. It's not just a bridge full of kids. It's the flagship of Starfleet full of kids.
Yeah. And it was really an unnecessary complication in the first film. And literally everybody winds up in their position.
Yeah.
Except for Chekhov and Sulu by accident.
Yeah.
So Scotty, Uhura, Spock, and Kirk all wind up. Although Spock returns to his original position, but they all wind up in their situation by accident. I'm not sure why that needed to be done that way, except they felt they needed to go from the cadet. They didn't want to jump another time period or something, I guess. But that does present a problem, I think, of a certain amount of believability. Although, if you save the Earth, I suppose, then you should get some kind of reward. But it would seem a promotion of a couple of ranks.
I could have seen him being more like a Kirk being a lieutenant commander or something like that, working his way up, being still under Pike. which was a different dynamic because Pike and Kirk, the only time they met was when the transfer of command in the original series. And I would have liked to see a little bit of that, the growing there, and actually more of an advance. I said, okay, you've gone from cadet to, hey, here's a captain seat.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah.
So, I mean, they didn't make Luke a Jedi Knight because he blew up the Death Star. So,
right.
So he still had to go through the process, and I think that would have. So I mean, that may raise some, and there is a little bit of that in the comics. I think this idea of inexperience and inability to deal with circumstances.
You see that especially with the Galileo 7, where the that ambassador is going off on Kirk, and sort of double guessing every command he gives. He's like, he's sort of looking at him like, you're just a kid. Why should I listen to you? Why don't I just take over? But of course, that's an ambassador versus a Starfleet officer. So.
Right. All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see where they go in the movies anyway. You know, I was going to say that I think when you save the Earth, it usually results not in a promotion, but in a demotion, right? Back down to captain. So, and you get a new ship out of it. It's kind of like if you're MVP of the Super Bowl, you get a car. But. But the comics have been very interesting so far. I do like the fact that as they have moved along, they've started introducing more changes to the timeline. I feel like in the beginning, they wanted to just kind of ease people in and then change things bit by bit more as they go. But
well, in the first issue, what I really like is the dynamic between Mitchell and Kirk is totally different than the Mitchell and Kirk from the Prime universe.
Mm-hmm.
Where
the
Prime universe, Kirk was the teacher of Mitchell. And in the JJ universe, Mitchell's like, so am I doing your homework again? Sort of, am I going to pull your physics homework out for you again? And the whole time, then that's how I got on here? Well, I need to have friends around me.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Versus where Kirk was actually in the Prime universe, an actual instructor at the academy, instructing these guys.
Hmm. Well, I think when looking at Where No Man Has Gone Before and the episode and the comic, there's an interesting dynamic in that when we watched that episode originally, in the 60s, we weren't aware that Kirk and Spock were going to become the best of friends. And whereas in this comic, since we know that that's faded, that they become the best of friends, it's almost like Mitchell is introduced as a way to bring Spock to Kirk more as a friend.
Hmm.
And I think that's different than in the original episode, where it was just this is sort of, it was more about the fact that this was Kirk's old friend and he had to make this tough decision of how to deal with that problem. Whereas in the comic book, it's this almost a handing off. And they do that with the chess game, right? Where Spock is not playing chess with Kirk.
Yeah, Spock doesn't want to play with Kirk at all because he's still holding a grudge for the movie. And so basically, and at the end, Spock goes, okay, I'll play a game with you, sort of after Mitchell's is gone. It's like, okay, let's play.
Right, and it's sort of a handing of the torch of like, if Mitchell was my best friend, now you are going to be my best friend. But that you don't get that in the original because that wasn't formed with the characters yet.
Yeah, he didn't have the animosity also in the original series because Spock and Kirk didn't know, they were just getting to know each other right there. They didn't have any past ties, and were in this comic. Yeah, you have that whole first a little bit of a past where Spock has a little bit of an admiration for, or he's starting to understand Kirk. Where and of course Kirk has the future Spock's saying, yeah, you're going to be good, my best friend. So it's trying to figure out how are they going to meet on that common ground and make a relationship work.
Well, we'll find out in the coming months where it leads and what we get in the movies. And but it's been interesting discussing it anyway, and especially seeing how four different people can pick up the different clues that are in the comics and where these things will go. So Sean and John, I really appreciate you joining us today for the discussion. Yeah. And before we go, real quick, Sean, tell everyone where they can find you around the web.
Well, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter, I'm Sean. I think it's Sean Taranjo, Twitter, whatever, at twitter.com. And then my DeviantArt site is strangio.deviantart.com. And that's my gallery where most of my Star Trek art is delving in an alternate mirror universe. So where the Terran Empire is strong has not fallen, and it has it's based loosely, all my art's loosely based off Diane Duane's original book called Dark Mirror.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I love that book.
Yeah.
So I loosely based my granted I loved all the DS9 Mirror Universe stuff, but I always like the fact that I love having the Terran Empire being strong. So.
Yeah, that's fun. All right. Mm-hmm. And we'll put links in the show notes to your accounts there so people don't have to try to spell your last name. All right. And John, tell us what you have going on and where everyone can find you.
Great. Well, if people are interested on Trek FM, there is information about the next two sets of talks that we're going to be giving my wife and I. About Ricardo Montalban and Khan. And if you would like to get in touch with me, in fact, I'm going to be putting a call out soon to the fan community. I'm trying to get together a presentation on the early history of Star Trek fan clubs and fan conventions. So if anybody has pictures or stories they'd like to send, that would be great. They can get in touch with me at the College of Lake County. Through the website there, it's clcillinois.edu, or they could email me at jtenuto, it's just J-T-N-U-T-O, at clcillinois.edu, and Illinois is spelled out. And also on Twitter, it's just jtenuto, so it's another way to get in touch with me. So it'd be great to hear from fellow fans, and especially if they have stories to share about the early days of conventions.
Excellent, excellent. And we'll put notes, links to all those in the show notes as well, so people can hop right over to you.
Great, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks again, guys, for joining us today.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you.
Well, Chris, it was great to have a discussion of an original series episode, but also a chance to actually talk about the JJ universe, the alt universe, as I like to say, which we haven't done too much, especially not in a positive light as of yet on this show.
That's true. But yeah, it was. And Operation Annihilate, although it is a somewhat bizarre episode, and possibly some people may think it was a weird springboard for us to use to talk about all of that. We did choose it because that is the most recent IDW comic story to come out.
Right.
Which just came out, I guess, last week, maybe, or the week before. And led us down a lot of unexpected paths, I think, into not only what happened in the first JJ movie, but what we might see come next year.
Yeah, very cool. I'm actually kind of glad that there was no Star Trek movie news so that we could not overload people too much. But it was really great talking about what we thought might be coming up
in
the next film.
Well, and I think the good thing here too, absolutely not to overload with too much about the movie, but I think the great thing about the way the discussion evolved was that yeah, we talked a lot about the movie, but, you know, we talked a lot about the characters as they were portrayed in the original series as well.
Yeah.
So that was fun. All right, Greg. Well, let's tell everyone how they can contact us if they want to share their thoughts with us, and we can have another mailbag segment. You can go to trek.fm/contact and send us a text message through there. You can visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/trekfm, or on Google+ at hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. And of course, you can find us on Twitter, which is where most people talk to us, and that is username TrekFM. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I am on Twitter at Greg Harbin, GREGHARBIN. And I was tweeting today as I wandered around Capitol Hill here in Seattle, where everyone has these hats with little animal ears on them. And I don't know if this is a new trend, but I'm definitely looking to make my Glommer hat next time I'm in Capitol Hill.
Oh, man. I got to see that. And you need to make sure that if you ever see the Google Street truck coming towards you, you slap on that Glommer hat and strike a pose. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can also find all types of other Star Trek stuff on our website at trek.fm, including articles. We have other shows, and you can play Trek Trivia. That's trek.fm/Trek Trivia. And you can follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter for even more quizzes. All right, Greg. Well, it's time to head out. Kirk has ordered me to shared confinement with Uhura. So I've got to run out and take care of that right now.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick an extra pair of eyebrows on it. because the Ready Room is done.